Welcome, everyone, to a very special edition of The Deep Dive.
Yeah.
If you are listening to this, I'm going to make a few assumptions about you.
Okay.
You are probably sitting in front of a suitcase that is maybe half-packed.
Mm-hmm.
You might be clutching a plane ticket to Paro, Bhutan. Or perhaps you're hovering your mouse over the purchase button on our website.
For that once-in-a-lifetime trip with us here at Best of Bhutan Tours.
Exactly.
That's right. Usually on this show, we dive into a wide range of, you know, more abstract topics, history, science, philosophy. But today, we are putting on our specific professional hats.
We are your tour guides.
We are. We're speaking directly to you, the prospective traveler who is about to throw themselves into the deep end of the Himalayas.
And you've seen the glossy brochures, right? You've seen the photos of the Tiger's Nest Monastery clinging to the cliffside.
It looks like something out of a fantasy novel.
It really does. Yeah. And you know about gross national happiness. But here's the thing about Bhutan, and I say this with a lot of love. You can book the absolute nicest hotel, the Aman or the Six Senses. You can hire the best driver in the country.
Get the most expensive hiking boots money can buy.
All of it. But if you don't understand the soul of the place before your boots hit the tarmac, you are going to experience a level of culture shock that might just, well, it might just break you.
That's a bold statement, but you know what? It's true. Most travel guides, the lonely planets of the world, they list the hardware.
The hardware, right.
The hotels, the trekking routes, the visa fees. That's all the hardware of the trip. Today, we're talking about the software.
The software. I like that.
We are discussing the mental and emotional operating system update you need to perform on your own brain to truly survive and actually enjoy the Himalayan kingdom.
And to do that, we're not looking at a standard guidebook. We are doing a deep dive into what I really consider the essential survival manual for any Westerner visiting Bhutan.
What's the book?
It's a memoir called Married to Bhutan by Linda Leeming.
It was published back in 2011, but I've reread it recently, and the insights are completely timeless.
They really are.
And Linda Leeming isn't just a tourist who spent a week there and, you know, wrote a blog post.
Not at all.
She's an American woman from Nashville, Tennessee, who did the unthinkable. She visited Bhutan, fell in love with the country, moved there, and eventually married a local artist named Namgye.
She went from what she calls the hamster wheel of the West.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the traffic, the scheduling, the ambition.
Just in constant running.
To a world without traffic lights.
Mm.
A world where magic is considered a historical fact and where time. Well, let's just say time is a suggestion.
A very, very loose suggestion.
So consider this your pre-departure orientation. Our mission today is to extract the survival tips from Leeming's life. We're going to unpack everything from the terrifying roads to the national obsession with chilies.
But we have to start with the biggest hurdle, the thing that actually causes tourists to have meltdowns in the hotel lobby.
It's time.
Time.
If you are coming from New York or London or Tokyo, you operate on linear time.
Right. You have a watch. You have a Google Calendar. You believe that 9 a.m. is a fixed point in the universe.
It is an objective fact.
And if you bring that mindset to Bhutan, you are going to lose your mind. Leeming talks about this concept right away. She calls it Bhutan stretchable time.
BST.
GST.
BST is real. And for a client of Best of Bhutan Tours, this is the first adjustment you need to make. But it's not just about people being late, is it? It's deeper than that.
It's so much deeper. It's a complete clash of civilizations. Leeming tells this incredible story about a friend of hers calling from London.
Okay.
This poor guy is trying to organize a job in Bhutan. It's February. He's sitting in London, completely stressed out, calling government offices in Thimphu, sending emails, trying to get paperwork signed.
When what happened?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Absolute radio silence. No one picks up the phone. No one replies to the email. He's panicking.
I would be too.
He thinks maybe there has been a coup or a plague. He asks Linda, has everyone left the country?
And Linda has to break the news to him. She says, you won't get anyone on the phone in February. It's migration season.
Now, in the West, when we hear migration, we think of birds.
Right. Geese flying south. Monarch butterflies.
We do not think of the government.
But in Bhutan, the government migrates.
Specifically, the monks migrate. The central monastic body. This is the Jekhenpo. He's the head abbot, basically the spiritual equivalent of the king. And about 800 monks.
800 monks.
Yeah. In the winter, Thimphu, the capital, is freezing. It's high altitude, bitter cold. So they pack up the entire religious infrastructure and migrate to Punaka.
Which is warmer.
It's a lower valley. It's essentially subtropical.
Wow.
Yeah.
And this is an ancient tradition. You have this visual of hundreds of red-robed monks moving across the mountain passes.
Yeah.
It must be beautiful.
It's beautiful. But for the guy in London, it's a complete nightmare.
Because everything just stops.
Because the migration signals the start of winter hours for the government. The bureaucracy slows down to a crawl. But here's the detail that I absolutely love. And Leeming highlights this as a prime example of how Bhutanese logic works.
Okay.
It's not just about the hours. It's about tights.
Tights.
Tights. Leggings. Long johns. This migration is the unofficial signal for Bhutanese men to start wearing tights under their goes.
Okay, we need to picture this. The go is the traditional knee-length robe men wear.
Right. It kind of looks like a bathrobe cinched at the waist.
And it exposes the calves. So essentially, the government shuts down early because the monks have moved and all the civil servants are pulling on black pantyhose because it's cold.
It creates a very specific aesthetic in the government offices, I'm sure. But yeah. The London friend, he's a Westerner. He tries to do the math. He says, okay, fine. Winter hours, maybe they work 10 to 4. That still leaves 6 or 7 hours in the day. Why aren't they answering the phone?
This is the part where Leeming breaks down the office hours reality. And listen closely, tourists, because this applies to you waiting for your permit or your driver. She says offices technically open at 9 a.m.
Technically is the operative word.
Oh, for sure.
In the U.S., if you work at a bank and you show up at 9:45, you're probably fired.
Yeah, you get a warning at least.
In Bhutan, civil servants usually arrive around 9:45. And why? Because they're bad employees.
No.
No, because they had to drop off their kids. Or they had to drive their brother-in-law to the bus station because his car broke down.
Family obligation trumps professional obligation every single time. And that is a hierarchy of values that is so hard for us to accept when we're waiting for a stamp on a visa.
Right. So the guy arrives at 9:45. He takes off his coat. He settles in. Is he working?
Of course not.
No, it is time for the morning tea break.
And that's not a quick cup at the desk.
No, no. That is 45 minutes.
45 minutes for tea.
Minimum. They catch up on gossip. They discuss the latest episode of the Indian soap operas, which are hugely popular there. They discuss the weather.
And then?
Then maybe they do 30 minutes of work. Then lunch is technically at 1 p.m., but they leave at noon to run errands.
Oh, of course.
And lunch isn't a sandwich at the desk. Lunch is a sit-down affair with rice and chilies, a proper meal.
Then they come back, and I'm guessing it's...
afternoon tea time?
Naturally. So if you're trying to get business done or you're trying to stick to a rigid itinerary, you are just setting yourself up for failure.
Completely. Leeming says they get in touch in their own time.
That's a great phrase. In their own time.
She also mentions the appointment window. This is so crucial for our tour groups. In the West, if a plumber says, I'll be there Wednesday at 10 a.m. and they show up at 10:15, we're annoyed.
Oh, we're writing a bad Yelp review.
In Bhutan, if someone says, come Wednesday, that actually means a 48-hour window.
Wednesday or Thursday.
It could be Wednesday, it could be Thursday. As long as they show up within that 2-day period, they are considered on time.
That is mind-bending for a Western brain.
It sounds chaotic to us, it sounds unprofessional, but Leeming gives this really interesting historical context for why this exists.
Okay.
You have to remember, until very, very recently, we're talking the 1960s, Bhutan was a foot travel culture in the Himalayas. There were no roads.
Right. She says if you are walking from one village to another to meet a friend, say from Thimphu to Paro, you're dealing with wild terrain.
Insane terrain.
You might encounter a landslide, or a bear, or a tiger.
Exactly. She says if you stop to climb a tree to avoid being eaten by a Himalayan black bear, you are going to be late.
And if a tiger chases you,
you might be early.
So historically, strict punctuality wasn't just rude, it was physically impossible. The fact that you arrived at all without being eaten was the success.
That is such a profound shift in perspective. And even though they have cars now, that arrival is a success mentality persists.
It's the difference between linear time and cyclical time.
Let's unpack that.
So, Leeming calls Western time the hamster wheel of doom.
I love that. The hamster wheel of doom.
It's perfect. We view time as a line. We're born at point A, we die at point B, and we have to cram as much achievement and productivity as possible into the space between.
We're always running, trying to get somewhere, but never really arriving.
And Bhutanese time.
It's cyclical. It's based on seasons, on crop cycles, and fundamentally on reincarnation.
Right, that's the key.
If you believe you have infinite lives, that you will be born again and again, you are not in such a frantic rush to finish your to-do list by 5 p.m. today.
If you don't get the permit signed today.
You'll get it tomorrow, or next week, or, you know, in the next life.
She describes her own conversion to this mindset in the book, and it wasn't instant. She used to commute to work in Nashville.
Right, driving in traffic, putting on makeup in the rearview mirror, drinking coffee, listening to the news, stressed about downsizing. She was just vibrating with anxiety.
And then she describes her commute in Bhutan. She calls it the cowpath commute.
Because it was literally a cowpath.
Literally. Instead of a highway, she walks to her teaching job along a dirt trail.
She's hopping over brooks. She is climbing over stone walls near outdoor latrines.
Which doesn't sound pleasant.
No, and she's actively avoiding fresh cow patties. It sounds physically exhausting and, frankly, kind of gross compared to a heated car.
But she says she arrives energized.
Because she is awake. She is present. She looks out and sees the mist on the river. She sees the snow-capped peaks. She feels the cold air. She feels like she's inside a National Geographic page.
She isn't thinking about the destination. She is in the journey.
She traded the hamster wheel for the prayer wheel.
And that is the takeaway for our tourists. When you are in Bhutan, leave your watch in the suitcase. I'm serious.
Just forget about it.
If the bus is late, look at the mountains. Breathe the air. Watch the stray dogs sleeping in the sun. You are on Bhutan stretchable time now. Fighting it is like fighting gravity.
Okay, so you've adjusted your watch. You've accepted that you might wait 2 days for a plumber. Now you have to physically get there.
Yes.
And Leeming does not sugarcoat this part of the experience.
Not at all. She calls the journey the Vomit Comet.
A charming nickname.
But entirely accurate from what she describes.
Let's talk about the arrival. If you're flying in with us, you are landing at Paro Airport.
Which is notorious in the aviation world.
It is. Only a handful of pilots, maybe a dozen or so in the entire world, are actually qualified to land there.
Wow.
It's in a deep valley surrounded by 18,000-foot peaks. Leeming describes the descent as the wings literally scraping the cliffs.
I've heard this. You have to bank sharply between mountains to even find the runway.
It's not a gradual glide. It's a tactical maneuver.
It is terrifying. But she says it signals that you're entering a hidden world. You're dropping out of the sky into a secret garden.
And once you land, you hit the roads.
Yeah.
And this is where the Vomit Comet comes in. This is the reality of travel in the Himalayas.
Because Bhutan is vertical.
Completely. There is almost no flat land. The roads are cut into mountainsides. Leeming notes that on the drive across the country, you might encounter 30 hairpin turns per mile.
30 per mile. Let's do the math on that. If you were driving 30 miles an hour, that is a turn every 9 seconds?
Something like that. It's a constant swaying, lurching motion. Left, right, left, right. For hours on end.
I'm getting motion sickness just thinking about it. And you aren't alone on the road. You're sharing it with what Leeming calls the Indian Tata trucks.
These trucks are characters in the story.
Yeah.
They're these massive lumbering vehicles that bring goods up from India.
And they're painted in these wild colors.
Psychedelic patterns, flowers, demons. She describes them as having jaunty faces painted on the front, but menacing behavior.
They barrel down these narrow one-lane roads like they own them. And they're carrying everything. Construction materials, food that is sometimes nearly out of date.
And people.
The people in the back of the trucks.
That is a sight. They hitch rides in the open truck beds. And because of the winding roads, those truck beds are often, well, let's just say, coated in evidence of motion sickness.
Hence the Vomit Comet.
And the Handy Boys.
The Handy Boys.
It's the nickname for the buses, because you have to be handy with a plastic bag if you ride them.
But it's not just the nausea. It's the danger. Leeming tells a harrowing story about a short stretch of road that had just fallen into a ravine.
This happens all the time. The Himalayas are young mountains. They are crumbly. Landslides are incredibly common.
So what happened?
She describes driving on a mud track with the abyss on one side and the cliff on the other, inches from death. The road had simply vanished.
And she's in the car, looking down at a drop that would turn a vehicle into a pancake.
And the driver's just casually maneuvering around a rock like it's no big deal.
Unbelievable. But here's the Besa Bhutan upside. Why do people endure the Vomit Comet? Why do they risk the landslides?
Because of what is waiting for them. She talks about the architecture in Thimphu, the capital. She calls it gingerbread gone mad.
I love that description. It captures the whimsy of it.
In the West, our cities are concrete and glass. Functional. Gray.
Yeah.
Thimphu is a riot of color.
Yeah.
Whitewashed adobe walls. Massive red and gold roofs. Elaborate paintings of lotus flowers and clouds on every wooden beam.
And it's strictly regulated. You can't just build a glass box in Thimphu. It has to look traditional.
But she warns prospective visitors, nothing is airtight.
No, this is traditional construction. The windows have shutters, but they don't seal like a German window.
The wind gets in. The houses are beautiful, but they are freezing in the winter. You wear your coat inside.
And there are no traffic lights.
Not a single one in the capital. They tried to install one once.
Oh, I remember this story from the book.
They put up a traffic light in Thimphu, but the people hated it.
They hated it.
They found it impersonal. They missed the policemen standing in the booth using white-gloved hand signals.
So they took it down.
They took the light down. It shows a preference for human interaction over mechanical efficiency.
And despite the harrowing roads and the cold houses, she says the air is delicious.
Delicious. That is the word she uses. It's crisp, pine-scented, unpolluted. The scenery makes you feel like you have stepped into a myth. So you endure the journey to be in a place that looks like Shangri-La.
So we have survived the flight. We've survived the drive. We've adjusted our watches. Now we have to interact with the people.
Right.
And this brings us to section 3, cultural etiquette and social dynamics. And the biggest shock for Liming, and for me, honestly, was the silence.
This is a classic Western versus Bhutanese clash. Liming admits that as an American, specifically a Southern American, she talks to fill space.
We do. We use chatter to simulate chemistry.
Yeah.
If there's a lull in conversation, we panic.
Oh, complete panic. We think, oh no, they hate me. I need to say something witty.
She tells a story about hitching a ride, which is very common there, totally safe, and getting into a car with a stranger, and she just starts unloading.
She's talking about her feelings. She's talking about her shoes. She's talking about the weather. She's doing that thing we do, narrating her existence.
And she realizes later the driver was physically wincing.
He wasn't just quiet. He was in pain.
Because in Bhutan, silence is valued. It's a form of respect.
She uses a beautiful metaphor to explain this. She says silence is like two amoebas in a drop of water, interacting but not talking.
Two amoebas in a drop of water. That's really lovely.
It conveys contentment. If we're sitting together in silence, it means I am comfortable enough with you that I don't need to perform. I don't need to entertain you. We are just being.
So, tip for our tourists. You don't need to fill every quiet moment with your tour guide or your driver.
Please don't.
If you are driving for 3 hours and no one speaks, that is a good thing. It means you are accepted.
Exactly. But there's a deeper cultural difference regarding how they see the world. And this is best illustrated by the pink goat story.
This is one of my favorite anecdotes in the book because it's so funny, but it's also philosophical.
So Liming is volunteering as an English teacher.
Right. And she visits another class taught by a strict old school Bhutanese teacher. The assignment was simple. Draw a goat.
Okay. Now, in a Western school, if a kid draws a goat, they can draw it however they want.
Creativity is king for us. If a kid draws a superhero goat or a rainbow goat, say, wow, good job. Very expressive.
Right.
So, in this Bhutanese classroom, one little girl draws a pink goat.
A pink goat. And the teacher explodes.
He gets angry.
He yells. He is furious. He shouts, there are no pink goats. There are white goats and black goats. There are no pink goats.
That seems so harsh. It seems like he is crushing her imagination.
From our perspective, yes. But we have to look at it through the Bhutanese lens. This is a culture that believes in dragons.
Right.
They believe in Naga spirits living in the ground. They believe in yetis. To them, the invisible world is real. It is factual.
So they have plenty of room for magic.
They have room for truth. A dragon is true in their worldview. A pink goat is just a lie. It's factually incorrect. It is a distortion of reality.
Huh. That is a fascinating contradiction. They accept invisible spirits as fact, but a pink goat is a step too far because it violates the natural order of things you can see.
Exactly. Liming's takeaway for the tourist is that you are entering a world where realism and magic coexist in a way that won't make sense to your Western logic. You just have to roll with it.
Don't try to argue that the pink goat is art.
Just draw the goat black.
Let's talk about the visuals of the people themselves, the clothing. We mentioned the tights earlier, but the national dress is mandatory for government, school, and formal occasions, right?
Yes, and it is stunning. For men, it's the goat. As we said, it's a knee-length robe, but the mechanics of it are fascinating. It requires a belt, a woven sash called a kara. And the way you belt it, you pull the fabric up over the belt, creates a huge pouch in the front called the hemchu.
That pocket is the Bhutanese equivalent of a Mary Poppins bag.
It is incredible. Li Ming mentions seeing men carry dishes, school books, sheaves of paper.
Even small dogs in there.
It is the ultimate utility pocket. You don't need a backpack if you have a hemchu.
And for women,
it's the kira. It is a floor-length rectangular cloth wrapped around the body. It's very elegant, very restrictive. It forces you to walk with a certain grace.
And it's held together by pins.
It's pinned at the shoulders with these beautiful silver brooches called koma.
And Li Ming actually describes her courtship with her husband, Namgye, involving the clothing.
She calls it the language of robes.
The language of robes.
In the West, flirtation might be a wink or a text message or buying someone a drink. In Bhutan, it was about how Namgye would straighten the pleats of his go.
Like a peacock preening.
Exactly. He would smooth the fabric, tuck his hands into his sleeves, or she would adjust her kira. It was very subtle. It was a dance of fabric.
It's a reminder to our tourists to look for the small gestures. The romance is in the details.
Before we move on to the spirits, we need to equip our listeners with some survival phrases from the book. You can't just go there and speak English the whole time, though many people do speak it.
You'll get by, but it's good to know a few things.
Definitely. The first one is Tashi Dalek. You will see this written on trucks, on signs, everywhere.
And what does it mean?
It means good luck or may all good things come to you. It's used as a greeting, a goodbye, a toast. It's an all-purpose blessing.
Tashi Dalek. Got it. And then there is Nami Sami.
Nami Sami. This is a fun one to say. Literally, it means between earth and sky.
That sounds very poetic.
It is. But it is used to mean very much or beyond measure. So if someone asks, did you like the monastery? And you say Nami Sami, you are saying, I liked it between the earth and the sky.
You will impress them.
You really will. But my favorite phrase she learned, and I think this should be the motto of our tour company, is see how I manage.
Ah, yes. She learned this from an old village woman. The woman was carrying a massive load of firewood on her back, probably weighing as much as she did.
Just struggling up a hill.
And she looked at Linda, smiled, and said, see how I manage.
It embodies the Bhutanese spirit, doesn't it?
It does. It's not complaining. It's not asking for help. It's stating a fact. Life is hard, the load is heavy, but look at me. I am managing. I am resilient.
It's a good mantra for when your hotel has no hot water or you are stuck in a landslide.
See how I manage.
Moving into section four, we have to talk about the spiritual side. But we are not talking about the boring, sit in silence, meditate under a tree kind of spirituality.
No. We're talking about the divine madman.
Oh, boy. If you are on a tour with us, you are going to see paintings on the sides of houses, traditional, beautiful farmhouses. And painted right next to the front door, 5 feet tall, will be a phallus.
A giant, erect penis.
Often with eyes.
Sometimes with wings.
Sometimes hair.
And the average tourist stands there and thinks, is this pornography? Is this a fraternity prank? Is this graffiti?
It is none of those things. Yeah. It is deep spiritual protection. It stems from Drukpa Khunli, a 15th century saint known as the Divine Madman.
He's the most popular saint in Bhutan.
By far. And he wasn't your typical monk.
No. He was a maverick. He criticized the rigid clergy. He drank alcohol. He seduced women. He hunted. He was wild.
And his legend says that he used his, well, these flaming thunderbolt of wisdom, that is the literal translation, to subdue demons.
He hit demons with his penis.
He did. He turned them into protective deities. So when you paint a phallus on your house, you are invoking Drukpa Khunli's power to scare away evil spirits and malicious gossip.
It's a symbol of safety, not sex.
You cannot make this stuff up. It is fantastic.
It really is.
And Li Ming tells a story about visiting a chorten, a shrine that supposedly contains a relic of Drukpa Khunli. Now, usually relics are things like a tooth or a piece of bone or a hair.
Right, something sacred.
She asks the monk what is in the shrine. He tells her it is Drukpa Khunli's actual underpants.
Laughs, the saint's underpants, of course.
And the people revere it. This is key to understanding Bhutan. Spirituality is earthy. It is humorous. It is body. It is not sterilized and separated from the messy functions of the body.
It's also deeply connected to the environment. You mentioned the natural order earlier. Li Ming talks about Naga and Lu.
Right. This is why Bhutan is so pristine. It's not just because of laws. It's because of fear.
Fear of what?
Naga are snake spirits that live in the earth. Lu are water spirits, and they are temperamental.
Very. If you pollute a stream, if you throw trash in it or pee in it, you aren't just littering. You are physically assaulting a loo.
And the loo will strike back.
Ooh.
Usually skin diseases or boils or bad luck. So when a Bhutanese person doesn't litter, it's not because they want to save the planet in an abstract Greta Thunberg way.
No, it's because they don't want to get a rash from an angry spirit.
It is spiritual pragmatism.
Yeah.
And it works.
She also touches on death. And this is something tourists might actually see.
It's a heavy topic, but it's necessary.
Uh-huh.
You might see smoke rising from a pyre by the river. That's a cremation. Or you might see white prayer flags clustered on a hill.
And what do those mean?
Liming explains that Buddhism views death as a transition, not an end. It's just changing clothes. You take off the old body, you put on a new one.
And she mentions the goal is to think about death 5 times a day.
5 times a day.
That sounds so morbid to a Westerner. Why would I want to ruin my day 5 times?
But Liming argues it actually makes you happier. If you acknowledge that you are going to die, maybe today, maybe tomorrow, you stop sweating the small stuff.
You don't get angry that the tea is cold.
You don't get furious that the internet is down. It keeps you grounded.
She mentions the story of a British tourist who died while trekking.
The lonely tourist. This is a tragic but really illuminating story. He was an older man, trekking in winter. He insisted on not wearing a coat. Some sort of British stoicism.
Oh, no.
He had a heart attack and died on the trail.
In the West, this would be a forensic emergency. Police, coroners, panic.
In Bhutan, the locals handled it with a practical casualness that shocked Liming. They couldn't fly the body out immediately. The body was starting to smell. It was becoming a health hazard. And it was an auspicious day for cremation. So they just cremated him.
Without the family there.
Yes. They did the rituals, they sent him off properly. To them, the body was just an empty shell. The man was already gone. It shows a comfort with mortality, a lack of squeamishness that we just don't have.
Now, let's get into the nitty-gritty of daily life. Section 5. We always hear about gross national happiness.
The king famously decreed that gross national happiness is more important than gross national product.
It's a great marketing slogan.
It is, but Liming shows what that looks like on the ground. It means modernization is slow and deliberate. They didn't allow TV until 1999. They skipped the Industrial Revolution entirely.
But let's talk about what really matters to a traveler. Food.
2 words. Chilies and rice.
Liming warns us.
Yeah.
In Bhutan, chilies are not a spice. They are a vegetable.
This is the most important culinary warning I can give. In the U.S., a jalapeno is a garnish. In Bhutan, a bowl of chili peppers is the meal.
And the national dish is imadatsi.
Which translates to chili and cheese. And it is nuclear hot.
They cook red or green chilies in a cheese sauce. And they eat it with mounds of red rice.
And they feed this to toddlers. Liming talks about watching babies sucking on chilies. Their tolerance is genetic at this point.
She writes about her struggle cooking for her husband, Namgay.
The rice wars. Namgay, like most Bhutanese, felt that a meal without rice was simply a snack. It didn't count.
So Liming tried to make pasta.
He washed rice. She tried to make pizza.
He washed rice.
It's the staple of existence. Red rice. It's nutty. It's delicious. But you will eat it 3 times a day.
And speaking of domestic struggles, the shopping, oh my gosh, the envelope story. This captures the inefficiency that drives Westerners crazy, but also the charm we talked about.
Okay, so Liming needs to buy envelopes. Simple task.
In the U.S., you go to Staples, you buy a box of 500, you are done in 10 minutes.
In Bhutan.
She goes to the market, she can't find envelopes. Someone tells her to go to the paper factory.
A paper factory?
She drives to the paper factory. She walks in and watches a man literally dipping a screen into pulp, making the paper by hand, peeling the layers off the drying easel.
It is artisanal to the max.
She buys the paper, but it's just sheets of paper. There's no glue.
Of course not.
So she has to go to another shop to find glue. And she has to fold them and glue them herself.
It's an all-day ordeal just to mail a letter.
It is, but she makes the point. It connects you to the source of things. You aren't just a mindless consumer picking a box off a shelf. You are a participant in the process. You met the man who made the paper. You smelled the pulp.
It gives value to the envelope that a box from Staples never has.
Conversely, she takes Namgay to America. She brings him to Nashville. And his reaction to a Western grocery store is priceless.
He calls it a temple.
A temple.
He walks into a Kroger or a Whole Foods and he is stunned into silence. The abundance, the lighting, the perfectly stacked apples.
And he is mesmerized by Clorox wipes.
Yes. the canister of Clorox wipes, the way you pull one out and the next one pops up automatically.
He thought it was magic.
He stood there pulling them out one by one, amazed at the engineering.
It really puts our convenience into perspective. We are addicted to convenience. They are accustomed to effort.
And that effort extends to relationships. Leeming's marriage to Namge wasn't just two people dating. It was a community event.
The communal courtship.
They were both teaching at a school. And in Bhutan, privacy is a foreign concept. Everyone knew they liked each other. The students were rooting for them. The other teachers were placing bets.
So when they finally got married,
it wasn't just their decision. It was the village's success.
And the wedding itself, it wasn't just one day.
Oh, no. It was endless. There was a Buddhist puja with monks chanting for hours. There was a civil ceremony where they had to put their thumbprints on documents. It was a marathon of ritual.
And then domestic life. The laundry wars.
The laundry wars? This is where the cultural clash hits the household chores. Leeming, the American, believed in soaking clothes.
Right. Put them in soapy water. Let them sit. Let the chemistry do the work.
Efficient. Lazy, perhaps, but efficient.
And Namge.
Namge, the Bhutanese man, believed in violence. He believed in scrubbing the clothes with a hard brush on a concrete floor until they surrendered. He thought soaking was doing nothing.
He thought you had to sweat to make things clean.
It shows that even in a fairy tale romance in the Himalayas, you still argue about housework.
But there's a sweet detail about the gender roles.
Yes. Namge could sew. He mended her tights.
Which is amazing.
In the West, we have these rigid ideas. Men don't sew. Men don't cook. In Bhutan, everyone needs to survive. If your goat tears in the mountains, you fix it. If you're hungry, you cook. Self-sufficiency trumps gender stereotypes.
So we have covered the time, the roads, the spirits, the food, and the laundry. As we wrap up this deep dive, we have to ask the big question. Why should our listeners actually go?
It's a fair question. Leeming is honest. It's not comfortable.
Leeches. Cold houses, bad roads, no plumbing sometimes.
Why leave your comfortable home to go there? Leeming uses a specific word to answer this, civility.
Civility? That's an old-fashioned word.
It is. She argues that in the West, we are addicted to comfort. We have optimized our lives to avoid all discomfort, but we are unhappy. We are lonely. We are anxious.
Whereas in Bhutan,
they struggle physically walking miles, carrying loads, freezing in winter, but they possess deep social capital.
They are connected.
They are never alone. They have a civility, a kindness that comes from knowing we are all in this struggle together.
She has this beautiful line that sums up the travel experience. You find things when you're looking hard for other things.
That is the essence of the trip. You might go looking for a photo of a monastery. You might go looking for a tiger. But you won't find those things easily.
No.
Instead, while you're waiting for the road to clear or waiting for the tea to brew, you find patience. You find a different way to view time. You find yourself.
She references the four faithful friends. You see this image everywhere in Bhutan.
It's on murals, in hotels, and restaurants. It's an elephant, a monkey, a rabbit, and a bird.
And they are stacked on top of each other.
The elephant stands on the ground, the monkey sits on the elephant, the rabbit sits on the monkey, the bird sits on the rabbit.
And it's a parable.
It's a parable of cooperation. The bird plants the seed, the rabbit waters it, the monkey fertilizes it, the elephant protects it. And by standing on each other's backs, they can reach the fruit high in the tree that none of them could reach alone.
It's the anti-competition model.
In the West, we are told to climb the ladder. Step on people to get to the top. Bhutan says, stand on my shoulders and we will all eat. That is the philosophy you are stepping into.
So her final advice for our tourists.
Leave your watch at home. Bring your sense of humor. You will need it when you are the only one wearing a coat in a hot office or the only one without tights in a cold one.
And expect the unexpected.
Expect the unexpected, like a rat jumping out a window or a road falling into a ravine.
To be ready to wake up.
Wake up. She quotes the Buddha. When asked if he was a god or a magician, the Buddha simply said, I am awake.
And Bhutan forces you to wake up.
It forces you to wake up because you can't sleepwalk through a place that is so vibrant, so difficult, and so alive.
Leeming suggests that comfort is a diversion. That is a provocative thought to leave our listeners with.
It is. We spend our lives building comfort zones, air conditioning, SUVs, scheduled deliveries. But if you stripped all that away, if you took away the conveniences and the schedules and the choices, what kind of happiness would be left underneath?
That is the question Bhutan asks you.
And if you are ready to answer it, Best of Bhutan Tours is ready to take you there.
Just don't ask us to be on time.
No, absolutely not. We will be there eventually.
Thanks for listening to this deep dive into Married to Bhutan. We will see you on the cowpath.
Toshi Delic.